It's 2:40 Central Time.
Time to go again to the A Moment of Science mailbag. A listener writes, Dear Don and Yael, I keep hearing that we're running out of oil. Is this true? Some geologists say that oil production may have already peaked, but others say there's lots more oil to be discovered. So, who's right?
Great question, and an important question, since we use oil for everything from powering cars and trucks to making plastic bags and running shoes. The answer is that we don't really know if oil production has peaked or not. It's hard to tell.
But why? There's only so much oil in the ground. So shouldn't we know how much of it we've already used and how much is left?
You'd think so, but it's not that simple. First, because big oil-producing states like Saudi Arabia keep that information secret. They want to keep the rest of the world guessing so they can more easily control the price of oil. And second, most remaining oil tends to be deep underground in hard-to-reach places. So it's hard to know exactly how much oil is left in known fields, let alone unexplored places like the polar regions and much of the ocean floor. There may be very little oil left, and there may be a lot.
Fine, but it's important to keep in mind that oil is a finite resource, and eventually it will run out. There's no denying that.
True. Even the most conservative experts agree that oil production will peak at some point within the next half century or so. Hopefully, by then we'll have developed other, cleaner sources of energy.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amomentofscience.org, where you can also view videos and sign up for podcasts. Once again, our web address, amomentofscience.org. I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, there's another weather-related postponement at the Olympics, this time because of too much snow. The men's super combined race scheduled for today has been called off due to heavy snowfall. The women's downhill training set for today has also been canceled. Patrick Kane of the Chicago Blackhawks and his USA hockey teammates begin their Olympic medal quest today. They're playing Switzerland in their opening game. Canada, with Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook of the Blackhawks, play Norway. The Bulls open a home-and-home series with the New York Knicks at the United Center tonight. And in college basketball, DePaul looks to snap a six-game losing streak at home tonight against Rutgers. Rutgers is coming off a big win over Big East power Georgetown on Sunday. And one more sports note, the Chicago Bears have fired Senior Director of Pro Personnel Bobby DePaul. After 9 seasons, he helped build a team that won 3 division titles and an NFC championship. He also played a big role in the trade that brought quarterback Jay Cutler to Chicago, which went 7-9 last season. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Preservation Emporium, a free public event on February 20th from noon to 4 at the U of I's Spurlock Museum, with preservation advice on family heirlooms from antique quilts to home movies. The keynote address, Preservation in Champaign County, by Bob Swisher, is from 1 to 2.
The U.S. government is spending millions of dollars to build bioenergy plants. They'll turn everything from wood chips to algae into energy. But these facilities are years behind what they're already doing in Europe, especially in Germany. In the first part of a 3-part series on biofuels in Europe, Sadie Babbitts takes us to one German plant that makes green energy on a massive scale.
We're in eastern Germany, where crews work on what looks like brew vats. These monster tanks remind me of vats for brewing beer, except these vats will brew energy from fermenting rye, manure, and bacteria.
Basically, we're standing here in front of the biogas and the biofertilizer production area. The big fermenters there are for the biogas production.
Oliver Lutka is our tour guide. He's really a chemical engineer for Verbio. The company is one of Germany's largest commercial producers of biofuels. Luca's been involved in turning this ethanol facility into a plant that makes ethanol and biogas. That's methane.
We convert nearly everything into energy by using biological processes. This combination of biogas and bioethanol production plant is not existing in the world.
That's what Verbio claims anyway. The company buys grain from some 4,000 farmers in the region. The grain gets turned into biogas and ethanol. Verbio then turns the minerals from making these biofuels into fertilizer. That goes back to the farmers for their crops.
We are closing the loop to the farmer because we are converting all the carbon molecules to energy, and the minerals we are converting back to the farmers, and the minerals are basically the fertilizers which the farmer needs to grow their plants, which we can then use to extract the energy.
Luca says the company has the technology to make this industrialized-sized plant profitable. That baffles skeptics because it costs a lot to make green energy. You have to buy the grain, and the actual process of turning that grain into fuel can be really inefficient. By the time you've made 1 gallon of biofuel, that gallon of oil is cheaper. Jan Liebetrau isn't convinced Verbio has the answer. He researches bioenergy and its potential in Germany.
Because you put otherwise lots of energy into the system and you get out bioethanol, which might be, from the energetic point of view, not valuable anymore. Because you put more energy in than you get out.
So making bioethanol costs energy, which defeats the whole purpose of producing it in the first place. Oliver Lutke at Verbio doesn't see it that way. He says Verbio has the technology to make biofuels without losing energy. And the company will soon accomplish that. And because the company's process is more efficient, Lutke says they've cut down on greenhouse gas emissions.
We emit 200,000 tons. The plants we are using will eat off 180,000 tons of this. And then that's a closed cycle.
It's not perfect, but there's less greenhouse gas being released than from burning fossil fuels. Lutke is convinced bioenergy will play a big role in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Germany, and Europe for that matter, have become leaders on this. Germany wants to be the first industrialized nation to be powered entirely by renewable energy, a goal Germany could reach by 2050, well ahead of the U.S. For the Environment Report, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
Tomorrow we'll continue our series on biofuels in Europe. We'll take a look at the crops for food or crops for fuel debate. Driving a Toyota may seem like a pretty risky idea these days. For weeks, there have been reports about sudden acceleration, failing brakes, and car recalls. But John Hamilton reports beliefs that these problems are greatly increasing the risk of driving have more to do with emotion than statistics.
When you talk about the Toyota situation with experts on traffic safety, the first thing they say is that sticky accelerators and faulty brakes need to be fixed. The second thing they tend to say is that even massive recalls like Toyota's don't do much to make drivers and passengers safer. Leonard Evans is a physicist, a former employee of GM, and author of the book Traffic Safety.
The whole history of U.S. traffic safety has been one focusing on the vehicle, one of the least important factors that affects traffic safety.
Studies show that the vehicle itself is almost never the sole cause of an accident. Drivers, on the other hand, are wholly to blame most of the time. A look at data on Toyotas from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration confirms this pattern. Evan says his review of the data show that in the decade ending in 2008, about 22,000 people were killed in vehicles made by Toyota or Lexus.
All these people were killed because of factors that had absolutely nothing to do with any vehicle defect.
Evan says during that same period, it's possible, though not yet certain, that accelerator problems in Toyotas played a role in another 19 deaths, or about 2 each year. Evan says people should take comfort in the fact that even if an accelerator does stick, drivers should usually be able to prevent a crash.
The weakest brakes are stronger than the strongest engine, and the normal instinctive reaction when you're in trouble ought to be to apply the brakes.
Evan says given all we know about the potential risks from Toyotas, we're far more frightened than we need to be. David Ropeek, a risk communication consultant in Massachusetts, says that's because our brains don't use logic when it comes to fear.
We don't calculate risk based on our probabilistic chances of something bad happening. We gauge risk based on, do we trust the people who have made the products we're taking, the pharmaceuticals, the cars, the neighboring nuclear power plant?
And Ropeek says often we don't, especially if we think they may have withheld information about the safety of a product. He says people also tend to think something is especially dangerous if it's being imposed on them.
Imposed risk always feels much worse than the same risk if you choose to do it yourself. Like if you get into one of these Toyotas and they work fine, but you drive 90 miles an hour after taking three drinks, that won't feel as scary, even though it's much riskier because you're choosing to do it yourself.
You might think people would feel safe if they are driving a car that's not one of the recalled Toyotas. But Robeek says that's not how our minds work. Instead, he says bad news about one car maker's product is likely to shake confidence in all cars. Robeek says something like that happened a few years ago with a medical device. The news media began reporting that one company was having problems with its implantable defibrillators and seemed to be trying to hide those problems.
When that hit the news, people with defibrillators from all major manufacturers rushed to the hospital to have them all taken out of their hearts. This will probably have an effect more broadly than just Toyota, even if all the other cars come up clean.
Of course, if people's fear of their cars causes them to avoid driving, they really will be less likely to have a crash. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Alexandra Penny had a lifelong fear of being homeless and destitute, despite a successful career as an author, artist, and magazine editor. 2 years ago, that fear materialized when she lost her life savings in the Bernard Madoff Ponzi scheme. Penny spoke about the experience, which she chronicles in her new book, The Bag Lady Papers, The Priceless Experience of Losing It All, with NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
I received a phone call from my best friend, and she said, Bernard Madoff's just been arrested. Isn't your money with him? The phone then rang again, and it was my son, and he said, Mom, Madoff's been arrested. You can come live with us. So he knew that I had lost all of my savings.
Where were you when that started? I mean, did you feel that you were in a comfortable, happy place until this happened?
I had saved all my money that I could save since I was 16, and I had worked since I was 16, and I had a nest egg, but I was using a little bit of Madoff money to balance out what I was not earning with my art. But then the art market tanked too, and nothing was selling. So my savings were gone, and not having a nest egg absolutely galvanized my fears of being a bag lady.
Of course, we're all wondering how much you actually lost. You don't mention the amount in the book.
That's the first question that people ask me.
Yes.
And first of all, in a relative sphere, it wasn't that much. But there are still lawsuits pending. So the lawyers have said you just can't talk about figures.
Now, do you have the book with you, I hope?
I do.
On page 43, you describe what you're afraid of. Can I just ask you to read that little passage?
You're going to lose your edge, I think. You'll be walking around with swollen ankles. You'll be holding your moth-eaten layers of old clothes together with rusted safety pins. Your hair will be grayish yellow and dirty and stringy, and you'll be cold and lonely and alone.
But you also write in the book that you have around you lots of souvenirs of richer days. You have very nice clothes, a very nice apartment with a lot of beautiful light, and still you write about being genuinely terrified, and I believe you.
I still have some remnants of my past life, but I have this visual image. I've had it since I was very young, and I grew up in comfortable circumstances of being alone with nowhere to live. This is a fear that many women have. I was a journalist, so I've talked to many women about this. It's a fear, really, of dependence, abandonment, and to have loss of control of one's life.
Now, the book began as a blog on the Daily Beast site. And I'm sure you're aware, although there were hundreds of people who sympathized with you, there were also posts that attacked you. Sort of poor little Alexandra Penny. One woman said, you have to sell the West Palm Beach house and let your maid go, wow, get over yourself.
I completely understand where that is coming from. But the vitriol was so extensive. People wanted me to get cancer. People wanted even worse for me. And the avalanche of anger, I think, reflected the anger that's going on in America. So I can understand how somebody who has a house who's foreclosed, who doesn't have a housekeeper 2 or 3 hours a week, which I had, would say, I don't feel sorry for you. There's far worse things that happen.
I wonder if you feel at all responsible for what happened to you. You put money with Bernie Madoff, and you felt lucky to be able to do so. You kept carefully filed all the statements that showed impossibly high returns from bad markets. Did you ever think, this is hinky, this can't be real?
Well, you know, I did not pay much attention to the statements. It was steady. It was like 9%. And I had talked to people that had gone to Harvard Business School. I asked, 10, 12, 15 people about Madoff. One person said, we don't know how he does it. The rest of them said, you're perfectly safe and you're lucky to be there.
You describe being wiped out and feeling that you had been wiped out, but in fact you were not. You had a cottage in Florida,
exactly,
a piece of property in the Hamptons, which is a place where lots of wealthy New Yorkers go in the summer. And you had considerable personal resources. The numbers of times you gathered up your talents and did amazing things. You invented the Pink Ribbon campaign for breast cancer. You wrote best-selling books. I mean, I get it that you were scared to death. I don't get why.
Well, first of all, I had no money left. How was I going to pay the bills? I had maybe, $4,000 in the bank when this happened. I had mortgages on those houses. One sold, so the mortgage is paid back. One is now rented. That's for sale, obviously. And the book deal helped tremendously to keep me stabilized on a day-to-day basis.
You talk about the priceless experience of losing it all. That's your subtitle. What does that mean?
First of all, I surprised myself. I had an amazing year of, for the first time in my life, asking people if, for instance, I could barter. One of the things I really like, need, depend on is having my hair looking good and being blonde. I couldn't afford it. So I very luckily said, if I take a portrait of you or trade art with you, will you help me out? So I learned to ask for things. I had a year of saying, I can't believe I'm going through this and I'm really doing okay. And that was like, now I can get through anything. I really believe I can.
Alexandra Penny, author of The Bag Lady Papers, The Priceless Experience of Losing It All. She spoke with Linda Wertheimer.
Earth and Sky.
February of 2010 marks the 80th anniversary of the discovery of Pluto by American astronomer Clyde Tombaugh.
I would just like everyone to realize that Pluto is the 10th largest object that goes around.